Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is June 4th, 2015. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, I'm flying from Sydney to Dallas and then on to Memphis tomorrow after 3 weeks in Australia and New Zealand. It's been a very productive time. For those of you who know that I drive, certainly over the last 3 years, I've been driving all over the United States trying to understand the economy on the ground. It's the same with the global economy and rebalancing. To really help understand what's going on, you have to be there. And it's been very helpful to do that in both Sydney and then Uluru and then Auckland and Wellington in New Zealand and, of course, back to Sydney now. I've been posting commentaries as I go. We have a new section on the left-hand side of our website. And you could, we list the most recent commentaries and Solari reports. So check that out. It'll help you to find the newest commentaries because they roll off the homepage fairly quickly. Take a look among several that we've posted on the trip down under. One of the things has been the recording of the Auckland speech last week. We just did the Sydney talk on Tuesday and talked a lot about planet debt and a lot about new technology and the speed of creative destruction, which people are very aware of here. We did not record that speech, so we won't put it online, but I will publish the slides. It was, as I said, a very rich discussion, a lot of discussion about what's going to happen when all sorts of technological change re-engineers labor and employment across really all industries and sectors. Australians and Kiwis are a very entrepreneurial crowd, so there's also a lot of discussion of how much opportunity there is in a number of areas, particularly education. Some other noteworthy trends that I've observed while I'm here is urbanization. When I was over in New Zealand, a lot of discussion about how much of the growth since 2007 has been in Auckland, which is the largest city and certainly the business capital. But you also see it here in Australia with Sydney getting a lot of the growth and the rural areas really hurting, same as we've seen in the United States. To my surprise, there was very little understanding of the emphasis that the United States is putting into space, the privatization of space activities. And so that was part of the speech that I think really informed the folks over here. The other thing that really strikes me is how much happier people are on a day-to-day basis in Australia and New Zealand. Again, I'm in the cities, but let me give you some statistics. In 1990, the per capita income in Australia was $18,000. The U.S. was $23,000. Then by 2013, Australia had pulled way ahead with per capita income at $67,000, while the U.S. was $53,000. So pretty significant difference. In addition, on land mass, which is equivalent to about 90% of the U.S., the Australian population is 25 million instead of 325 million. So much less density, a lot more space. And of course, the weather is tropical and subtropical. It's quite beautiful, and you feel the real momentum of the growth in Asia. Obviously, a beneficiary in the resource sector for many years of what the demands of Asia for all sorts of mining products from Australian commodities. But I would also note that there's plenty of unhappiness with the centralization going on. It's all here, too. Interestingly enough, Australia is reported to be number two in the world in terms of taking antidepressants after Iceland. So clearly the stress of modern life is here. If you're interested in more, I'm going to be publishing several commentaries over the next week to round out sort of a report on what I saw and what I learned. And the equity overview next month on the Solari Report will focus on a report on the Australian and New Zealand equity markets. Our theme tonight is the pro-centralization team is having a Humpty Dumpty moment. Clearly, we see troubles with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, lapse now in the Patriot Act, many of the provisions getting picked up in the passage of something called the Freedom Act. I've posted the Electronic Freedom Foundation report on the Freedom Act. They seem to think it's an improvement. I'm pretty skeptical because it leaves the bulk collection still in the hands of the telecommunications companies, which is even worse than having it in the NSA, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, we have also the court challenges to the NSA spying. So as far as I'm concerned, it's just more power into the private telecommunications, social media and defense contractors, which I think is even more dangerous than having it in government. But it does look like the U.S. administration is getting bogged down in the mud on numerous of the control issues. One of the things you see, and I think it's part of the a defense of or a response to the kind of ways that things are bogging down, Mr. Global is very committed, or certainly the U.S. leadership is very committed to dressing fascism up with skirts. I'm going to be writing about this more. We see women being pushed for business leaders, for political candidates, sort of the idea is it's going to make for a warmer, more friendly leadership. I don't think it's going to work, but it's certainly going to make the divide and conquer propaganda for the next few years even more offensive. And that's something that we really need to think about, because the most dangerous divide and conquer is the divide and conquer between men and women. And it's extremely important to me on the Salieri Report that I do everything I can to help this kind of propaganda not turn men and women against each other, which it clearly is designed to do. I published a commentary this week called Restoring the Balance, and it was to help explain why we're watching so many mediocre candidates promoted. It's interesting, in the election, the mediocrity of the sort of lead candidates created by nepotism, I think is part of the lack of interest in the candidates has caused a lot of candidates to be able to get support and money because they're trying to throw up people who are a little bit more authentic, who can create a lot of interest in a process, which is very, from which the U.S. population is terribly alienated. Examples are Ben Carson and Carly Fiona. I don't think it's going to work. There's so much deep disgust, and you almost worry about how much violence it's going to take to stuff that deep disgust back in the box. I've really been amazed at comments I've been getting while I'm in Australia and New Zealand about how shocking many people, whether it's citizens down here or other sort of global travelers I'm talking with, how shocked they are and quietly frightened by the mediocrity of the U.S. leadership. And so one of the reasons I wrote Restoring the Balance was to encourage us all to remember that there are many authentic leaders in our lives, and it's important to support them and try and find a way to ignore the mediocre leadership, particularly created by nepotism. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. We're all just going to have to help each other. Money and markets. We're really seeing a lot of the different markets back down as we approach summer. Let me just run through the roll call. And, of course, real talk and concern about what happens when interest rates start to rise. So we're really seeing softness again. We are significantly overdue for a 10 to 25% correction in the equity markets. And I think one of the big questions is, will we get that this year? S&P now up 2.7% for the year. The DAX now up 17%. China leading the way, up 19%. Lots of commentary in the press to make you think China's on the verge of collapse. And I think that's part of the U.S. folks sort of jawboning in response to the market. But again, PE is much, much lower in China and the emerging markets. And I think that's one of the reasons we're just seeing the divergence close a little bit that's happened as the U.S. market shot ahead for the last 3 years. Developed markets minus North America now up 11% for the year. Emerging markets still up 4%. If interest rates do go up and the dollar goes higher, we could really see emerging markets get hammered, particularly the ones with U.S. dollar debt. U.S. dollar index hit 97 and is now back down to 95 as yields have started to sneak up a little bit. The bond market now, the AGG, the ETF bond aggregate, off 1.2% down for the year. And TLT down 6.7% for the year. That's a big drop after a strong year last year. Gold is now flat for the year. Silver up 5% for the year. Oil had a good week. Was up about 4.7% over the last 5 days, but it's down 2.3% for the year. So just a lot of softness coming into market, into the summer, and I don't think that necessarily means anything. To be expected. Healthcare, article from the Wall Street Journal, and I have to say you heard it on the Salary Report. I told you this was going to happen, and sure enough it is. Let me just read it. Health insurers seek hefty rate boosts. Major insurers in some states propose substantial rate increases for plans sold under the federal health law, setting the stage for an intense debate over the law's impact. In New Mexico, market leader Healthcare Service Corps is asking for an average jump of 51.6% in premiums for 2016. The biggest insurer in Tennessee, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee, has requested an average 36% increase. Maryland market leader CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield wants to raise rates 30.4% across its products. Moda Health, largest insurer on the Oregon Health Exchange, seeks an average boost of 25%. All of them cite high medical costs incurred by people newly enrolled under the Affordable Care Act. This is one of the reasons I have certainly never signed up for the for Obamacare. I don't think the system will ever work. I think the result is you're going to get coverage, but not health care. And our option is to spend our money on fresh food and health care, or we can spend it on insurance and run the risk that it will turn out not to be worth much. Another thing to keep an eye on, I posted a link from Charles Smith's blog. He posted some very good Federal Reserve statistics. U.S. retail is clearly struggling. I think Smith would describe it as collapsing, but there's clearly a big dip down, which is disturbing coming into summer. You would expect sort of a little pickup in the spring, but it'll be interesting to see how things go between now and fall. We keep hearing the Fed say they expect the economy to pick up, but with retail collapsing like this, I'm not sure how it happens. I believe Obamacare was a big contributor to that collapse, and the lower gas prices are not enough to offset it. Another commentary that I wrote, real estate juicing the U.S. housing market. The administration is making very significant strides on injecting a fair amount of credit and money into the U.S. housing market, trying to build a flow. And given how much money may come out of the bond market, it wouldn't be surprising to me if they can do it. But the reason I keep pounding the pavement on this topic is if you are in a community where 3.0 money is going in, then that's a tremendous amount of support for a stronger housing market in those areas. And I want to make sure if you're looking to buy a home, you don't get shut out. So please take a look at that commentary and pay attention. If you're in a market that's not the beneficiary of the 3.0 money, you probably don't have to worry. If we get increases, it probably won't be significant. So there's tremendous divergence market to market. But again, if you're in a area getting lots of 3.0 reinvestment, you need to pay attention if you want to make sure you don't get shut out. I also posted, Mary Meeker is a partner at Kleiner Perkins and every year does an analysis of internet trends. I always post her commentary, which I think is a very excellent overview of the internet and what the impact is in a variety of different ways in the economy. Let me just give you some of the statistics from that. Meeker sets the stage by saying two-thirds of a generation into the internet. There are about 2.8 billion users as of 2014. That's up from 35 million in 1995. In 20 years, that's a 39% of the world's population moving in to the internet usage. Then she also points out 5.2 billion mobile phone users. That's up from 80 million in 1995. And that's 73% of the population versus 1% in 1995. She says the market cap of the top 15 companies providing services in using the internet and mobile phones have gone from a valuation of $17 billion to over $2.5 trillion. That is very significant given that the entire global equity markets are $70 trillion. And I think it's important, and it really helps to look at Meeker's presentation. You understand the power of this platform when all 7 billion are on it, because there's so many functions. Once you get 100% access in a country or globally, then there's all sorts of functions that can go and work through that medium that can't now. One of the things Meeker points out is that education, the impact on government and education has just begun. I agree with that. And as those things kick in, we're going to start to see a lot of very significant change in those sectors. And for those of us who are entrepreneurs, there's a lot of opportunity. So one of the things we talked a lot about in the Sydney speech was what happens to education when people start making the decision that the certificate doesn't matter anymore. It's the authentic education that matters. And when will that happen? How will that happen? And I think it's going to happen. And when that wall comes down, you're going to see extraordinary shifts in how education happens. A couple things going on in the precious metals world that I want to underscore to you. Texas has a new depository, and Franklin Sanders sent out an email. He sat down and looked at the legislation and really unpacked it, and I thought it was pretty interesting, and that's up on the blog. Texas is a very unique state. It has a lot of infrastructure so that it can go its own way if it has to. I find it very interesting that they're creating that depository. BitGold bought Gold Money. I know there are a fair amount of subscribers over the years who've been exposed to Gold Money or put money at Gold Money. Bitcoin Gold is buying Gold Money. Bullion Vault got a hold through the merger process of Gold Money's financials and did an analysis, which I think is worth reading. I put it up on the blog. I think there are real questions about how Gold Money is going to fare as a result of the merger. Anyway, if you're at Gold Money, I would encourage you to take a look at that post. Then finally, we will post a link from Zero Hedge. Greenspan, Dick Fisher, and Larry Lindsey did a discussion of what happens when interest rates start to rise. And you almost... I was stunned at the cluelessness of the participants. You almost can't believe they're that divorced from reality, but I'm afraid they are. They tried to blame our financial situation on contingent liabilities and retirement obligations like Social Security, which is astonishing. They think somehow we don't know that, you know, $40 trillion plus has just been stolen. Apparently, it wasn't hard to give the banks $27 trillion. And the theory that the problem is the entitlements is simply flies in the face of the facts and reality that the American people now understand as a result of the bailouts. So that spin was very clever in being pushed in 2007. But post bailouts, I just don't even begin to see how that's going to work. So I've rarely seen a better example of the hubris bubble of the U.S. leadership. It's kind of frightening. Our hero this week, we've got two. One is that Malcolm Gladwell, wonderful author of a couple of great books on economics and sort of how change happens, decided to take John Paulson, the hedge fund manager, for his $400 million gift to the Harvard University. And if you know what's going on in the Harvard endowment and the games they play in the markets, along with John Paulson, who made a lot of money on shorting the housing market, you just have to say to Malcolm Gladwell, thank you very much. Vox published the tweets, and we'll put it up on the blog. And if you want a good laugh, take a look. It's pretty funny. Our other hero this week is Alistair Thompson, the publisher of Scoop Media. Take a look at my commentary, Recharging with Alistair Thompson. Alistair is someone who's had a very big impact on global media, and working with a very sort of leading website in New Zealand has kept New Zealand media alive almost single-handedly, and also has contributed mightily to all sorts of transparency on global issues, including financial fraud. I always, when it was announced that Australian investors had taken quite a loss on U.S. mortgage securities, I thought, well, I guess, you know, maybe they should have paid attention to what Scoop Media said, because Scoop was down there warning them all along. What was amazing, I had several days in Wellington with Alistair, and it was a great time to get caught up. I was really stunned by the speed of media debasements that's happening in New Zealand. New Zealand has 4 million people. It's one of the most literate populations in the world. And New Zealanders have always been intensely interested in government and cultural and civic life. And so to watch the debasement of the corporate media, one of their top shows had just experienced being shut down, despite the fact that it was successful and popular, and almost layoffs of about 180 people was happening. And the word on the street was basically get ready for nothing but reality TV shows and heartwarming, you know, cooking shows for the next 5 years. So I'm really hoping that Alistair and Scoop Media can keep real media alive down in New Zealand. And even though New Zealand is far away, given his contribution to the global conversation, it's something we all have an interest in, and it's something I'm going to continue to work to do, is to make sure that Scoop Media simply stays in the game long enough, because I think once the world has had its fill of reality TV show, we're all going to need the kind of news you need to have a functioning culture and economy. So it was very inspiring to spend that time with him, and he is absolutely one of my heroes. Ask Catherine, we got a great question on an article about the Lake Mead water level mysteriously plunging after a Nevada quake. The question was, is this water for underground bases? I have no idea, but there's no doubt about it that if you look at the areas where there's significant underground bases, you do see or does appear to be a drop in water levels. But whether it was a shift in the underground formations or underground bases, who knows? But, you know, it's all another one of the many anomalies we see all day long. Hi, Catherine. Did you listen to Marshall Masters on Coast to Coast tonight, Thursday, May 21st? He's the first person I've heard that sounds like he knows the true story about the $1 trillion chemtrail. And he goes on to give various explanations of what Marshall says it is. I just would be very careful to accept one explanation. I think we don't have the knowledge we need to really be sure what this is. And I would encourage everybody, if you're interested, to listen to the Clifford or read the transcript of the Clifford Carnicom special we did, where he lays out all the possible explanations. And when you spend this much money on a global spraying program, I assure you it has more than one purpose. It has, you know, the leadership is very big on stacking functions, and this is very expensive. So, but I appreciate your sending me that that recommendation, and I continue to be intensely interested in what it's all about. Dear Catherine, here's a story I wanted to pass along showing the FBI's flying surveillance missions over U.S. cities while utilizing fictitious business names when they're conducting the operations. I went ahead and put that link up on the blog. Then someone I'd love to hear you interview on the Salieri Report is Dr. Marcia Angell, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. She has lectures posted on YouTube where she totally blows the whistle in the pharmaceutical industry. She's gotten very good recommendations from Rappaport, so I appreciate that, and I will take a look. ¶¶ Let's go to the movies. Great documentary. It's called Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage. It's a documentary about one of the most popular rock bands in the world, Canadian rock band Rush. And you have probably never heard of them. I had never heard of them before I watched this documentary. And I'm somebody who listens to and pays a lot of attention to music. But it's amazing. They're off the corporate media map entirely. And when it was first suggested I watch this documentary, I thought, why would I care about a rock group from Canada? Well, let me tell you, talk about three guys who've led a free and inspired life. They started off as, you know, building the band. It started to be very successful, and they got a lot of pressure to do certain things, to be sort of corporate. Refused to do it, said, you know, we just want to do this our own way. We want to write the music. We want to enjoy the life. And they were able to build a following, which is quite significant, doing concerts, quite significant audience, all through word of mouth, all through their own website and efforts, just doing it their way. And it's probably the most popular rock band you've never heard of, but it's a marvelous story of another example of these things that are very, very popular with the audience, but for a variety of reasons never make it into the corporate media, so we don't necessarily know about them. And even if you don't love Rush's music or you don't love rock, just seeing the story of a couple of guys who decide to live a really free and inspired life is very inspiring. So I really encourage you to watch it. It's one of those really feel good or feel good documentaries. Our interview is with one of my favorite investment advisors and portfolio strategists, Don Cox. Don has an extraordinary history in commodities, and one of the great things about Don is he can talk all the way up from the farmer's point of view up into the global market. You know, he can look at it from Mr. Global's point of view or from the point of view of a small farmer or a consumer. So he can talk top to bottom and bottom to top. He has a new report out on the negative interest rates and has spent a lot of time thinking and talking about this and, of course, has a great grasp of history. So, and he's offered to let us use some of the graphs from his latest report for our transcript. So we'll have them up in the transcript when they get done. Anyway, if you're interested in the extraordinary and unprecedented going of interest rates into the negative, I encourage you to listen to it. Great interview, great person. Okay, that's it for today. Again, I'm back on a plane and leaving Sydney on a Friday and flying 17 hours and arriving in Dallas on a Friday. It's the advantage of being a day ahead. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Bilderbergers with Dr. Joseph Farrell. The Bilderberger meeting in Austria is coming up this in June, so a perfect time to talk about it. And we'll pick up on his discussion of how he believes the Bilderbergers were part of the sort of taking of the World War II loot and the Nazi interests and integrating it into a governance system using the Bilderbergers. So that's going to be interesting. June 18th, my favorite congressperson, Marcy Kaptur, is going to be joining us to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then, concerned as I am about the nationalization of the police force, I've asked Junius Ricardo Stanton to join us on June 25th. We'll be talking about unpacking Baltimore. As you know, I think it's very much an engineered operation, but that's my deep prejudice. We'll see what Junius says about it. So until next week with Dr. Joseph Farrell on the Bilderbergers, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.